Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Garden State Debate. I'm Ryan. I'm the host. And today we have a very special guest with us, Senator, Commissioner, Board Member. We'll have to ask him what he'd like to be addressed by. Bob Gordon with us today on Garden State Debate. And we're going to be talking about a lot of things, as he's had a very long and distinguished career in public service here in New Jersey. Including spending time in the New Jersey State Legislature, as well as other things before that in public service, and then now moving on to being a commissioner, one of five commissioners in the Board of Public Utilities here in New Jersey, as well as being a board member as of earlier this year of New Jersey Transit. So. That's very high level, and there's going to be a lot of stuff to talk about, so I don't want to waste any more time. So with that, I'd like to welcome you to the show, Mr. Gordon. Thanks for coming on. Happy to have you.
Well, the answer to your first question, you can call me Bob, because making reference to Commissioner Gordon reminds everyone of Batman.
All right.
Let's keep it simple.
All right, I'll go with Bob. That'll save us some time on a lot of the content that we have to get through too. So I appreciate that. But I guess if we can just kind of, we'll start from square one and think back to how you got into public service and then move through New Jersey Transit or the legislature, New Jersey Transit and the BPU kind of in that order. But is it, as things mix together as they often do, that's fine as well. So I guess my first question to you, Bob, is how did you get into public service? What drew you to it here in New Jersey? And kind of what were the first things and bells and whistles that went off that?
Well, you know, I have to warn you, you're asking at least a politician in remission to talk about themselves. So this could go on for a few hours, but I'll try to abbreviate this. I've been interested in current events, public affairs, public policy for as long as I can remember. I moved into a new house this summer and I was going through all my memorabilia, hopefully trying to pitch some things. And I came across an 8x10 picture of my Cub Scout pack. I had to be 8 or 9 years old, and we were all posing on the steps of the US Capitol with United States Senator Clifford Case, who actually may have been the last Republican elected to the US Senate from New Jersey. And I can actually remember that experience of being in Washington and seeing the Capitol building and the White House. And, you know, I just found it enthralling. And then, sort of came of age in the 60s and 70s, which were a tumultuous period for the country. And I can literally remember asking my parents if I could stay up late in November of 1960 to wait for the final returns to come in and the Kennedy-Nixon race. And I remember Kennedy's inaugural address with the Ask Not What You Can Do speech. So all that was going on. It was an environment that I think had a lot of people my generation interested in what was going on in the world and in their country. At the same time also, I had some cousins who were very involved politically. My parents were not involved in politics at all. No one in my family other than these cousins of mine were, and they were very involved in the civil rights movement. They had been to Selma, Alabama. They were very involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement. They they, I guess you could call them Greenwich Village liberals. And it was not uncommon to go over there and see Bella Abzug, the congresswoman from Greenwich Village, sitting at the dining room table. So I was exposed to people who were, you know, very involved in the events of our time. And, you know, 1968, it was my other year I graduated from high school. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. There was the Tet Offensive. Lyndon Johnson took himself out of the presidential race. It was just a tumultuous time. So I get to my college campus and I got very involved in the environment movement, the so-called ecology movement. Got involved in the planning of what was then the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. Started taking a lot of courses in environmental affairs, environmental policy. It turned out to really become my academic minor. After a summer of working in my father's textile factory, unair conditioned, I decided that there had to be something better than this. And so I decided I wanted to get an internship in Washington. And I applied for a college program. I was accepted. And I got a call one day from the White House. I guess there weren't a lot of college students who had expressed an interest in working at the White House for Richard Nixon. So I ended up being a White House intern. And I was thrilled to be attached to the President's Council on Environmental Quality the summer that organization was created, the same summer that the EPA was created. People forget that Richard Nixon actually had a pretty good environmental record. So that would be the first of several summers that I spent in Washington. I got a condition that Woodrow Wilson called Potomac fever, which is causes, as he put it, a swelling of the head and in some cases a loss of vision. But for me, it was just, I was totally enamored with Washington. And after that first summer, I returned the following summer to work on Capitol Hill for a New Jersey congressman who became a lifetime friend. It was just a lot of exciting stuff going on. I worked on the presidential campaign of 1972 for Senator Muskie, who was the author of some major environmental legislation. I just decided I wanted to pursue this interest in public affairs. And for me, unlike a lot of people in politics, my first love is really public policy and policy analysis. And elective office has really just been the avenue I've followed to pursue that. I take some pride in being called a policy wonk. I was more interested in driving policy than just, you know, standing in front of the local grocery store electioneering. In any case, as college came to a close, I had the opportunity. I had thought about going to law school, but other more interesting things keep turning up. I got an opportunity to be a research assistant at a public policy think tank in Washington, really one of the major ones, called the Brookings Institution. And I became a research assistant to a prominent economist named Charles Schulz, not to be confused with the cartoonist from Peanuts. He had been Lyndon Johnson's budget director and would later become Jimmy Carter's principal economic advisor. And I was I was the guy who crunched the numbers and did the fact checking for the books he was working on. One prominent one called Setting National Priorities on the Federal Budget. I just had a great deal of interaction with some great economists and public servants, including Alice Rivlin, who would later become the first director of the Congressional Budget Office, and other people who became governors of the Federal Reserve. It was in some ways, my career was all downhill from there. It really was quite a fantastic experience for a 21-year-old. Again, I was thinking about going to law school after that, but then something happened. I got an opportunity. I thought, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll get a graduate degree in public policy and then go to law school. So I went to Berkeley for 2 years, got a master's in public policy. And then as I was about ready to apply to law school again, something else interesting happened. The Congressional Budget Office was created and a new congressional budgeting process was created in Washington, which at the time was the hottest thing in public policy going on. And the people that I worked with at Brookings were all the architects of this. So it was relatively easy for me to get hired as a budget analyst at the Congressional Budget Office and be there at the very beginning. And that's what I did. And I was literally there at the very beginning when they were assigning people to areas where they didn't necessarily have great experts. But when I joined them, they learned that I had written my master's thesis on price fixing in the dairy industry. So that made me the closest thing to an agricultural economist they had. So they assigned the agriculture department to me, and I ended up being the person responsible for figuring out the cost of all the major agricultural and commodity legislation, which was grunge work at the time, but it actually was an excellent professional experience, which, you know, actually served me well later, decades later in the legislature. So there I was spending a couple of years on Capitol Hill, sitting in the gallery of Congress, watching my numbers being debated between Hubert Humphrey and Fritz Mondale and Senator Muskie and Senator Bellman. It was heady stuff. And I decided at that point, you know what? It's probably more fun making public policy than analyzing it. And I think at that point I decided, I think I want to run for office. So I decided to, and at this point I decided I don't want to go to law school. But I also knew I couldn't support myself outside of Washington with a public policy degree. So I decided at that point to go to business school, which I did. And then having completed that, I returned to New Jersey. I moved back to my hometown of Fairlawn. My parents were just moving to a new house. I moved into their old house, the house I grew up in, and started dabbling in local politics. And in 1981, my town of Fairlawn reorganized itself. So all five council seats were up. And it was a nonpartisan election. So something like 16 or 17 people were running for those five seats, including me. It was a nonpartisan election, but I tried running with the Democrats, and I think I must have come across as a little too aggressive, and they didn't know much about me, so I didn't get their nomination. So I ran with a bunch of independents. In the end, I came in like number 7 out of 5. I lost by 23 votes out of 8,000, and went back to the consulting firm where I was working and just thought, well, that's so much for politics. And then in a couple of years, the town reorganized itself again into a partisan town, and the Democrats needed a slate of candidates. And so they saw how hard I worked. I went door to door, knocked on thousands of doors. They saw I was a fairly good candidate. And so I got their nomination. And in 1985, I was elected to the Fairlawn Borough Council. I ended up spending 10 years on the council, 3 years as mayor. That's how I got started.
No, that's great. And it kind of already connects some dots of, I think, things that we'll be talking about later that you're involved in now, that you developed interest in at such an early age. So I find that very interesting. And I was gonna ask you as well, like in that kind of, getting started in your public policy career in terms of elected office. You mentioned knocking on doors. Do you see that certain qualities, characteristics for someone who might be listening or watching in terms of how to go about a good obviously there's different ways to do it. A good campaign and from a local level, is it? And do you see that kind of being the same now? Obviously you're not doing that, but you know what's out there in terms of social media, things like that. But
well, you know, of course, you know, this was in the 80s and 90s before Facebook and social media.
Right.
It was also before the pandemic. But I became, well, first of all, I would say hard work goes really far in improving your chances of getting elected. You know,
you,
I just always,
you obviously have the resume from what you described as well. So shopping that around obviously was a benefit to you, but then the actual tactics.
I became a great believer in retail politics. First of all, in every campaign, even in non-election years, I have been known just to go door to door. That's a pretty powerful thing, actually, when you're not running for office and you knock on someone's door and they say, well, when's the election? And I say, well, there is no election this year, but I like to walk my district and just hear what my constituents are thinking. That delivers a very powerful and positive message. But I always walked, I mean, we would knock on thousands of doors, my running mates and I, in a very strategic way. Certainly in the last few elections, you actually know, you are very selective in the doors that you knock on, because it makes no, we are now able to categorize our voters as in terms of their probability of voting for you based on, you know, a lot of data that's publicly available. So right. I would never knock on doors of people who are, we knew would vote for me or would never vote for me, but the persuadable ones. But at that early stage, at the local, when I was on the Fairmont Council, I would, you know, I started with my high school classmates as my base and worked from there. And I became a, as I was saying, a great believer in retail politics and just going to every event. I mean, every weekend was filled with Eagle Scout ceremonies and, you know, parades and ribbon cuttings and getting on the cover of the weekly newspaper that existed at the time. And, you know, that still counts for a lot, I think.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I was thinking as well. You know, with the advent of social media and everything that goes along with the internet, it kind of might wash itself out for a lot of people in the face-to-face time that you've described in terms of running for election. Seems to be one of the most valuable things that people still do today, at least in New Jersey and in the areas that myself, family, and friends have lived. So that definitely makes a lot of sense. So just moving in to the time that you spent then from there, from council and mayor to the New Jersey state legislature, starting with the assembly, I believe it was—
Actually, there was something that happened before then.
Okay.
You know, there's a theory that everyone can get to do something really stupid in their life.
I like that theory.
I would say that mine was occurred in 1996. So I had, you know, I had left the Fairlawn Council in 95, because, you know, one of the things I failed to do is when I picked my jurisdiction to move to, I didn't appreciate the fact that Fairlawn was in a legislative district that, you know, to this day has not elected a Democrat since John Kennedy's time. So there was no place for me to go. So, I mean, the natural progression would have been to run for the legislature from municipal government. So I left the council in 95. I was working with a hospital consulting firm, doing a lot of traveling, but I really missed public life. And you know, as often happens in politics, one of those unforeseen developments occurs that creates opportunities. So what happened was Bill Bradley, who was the United States Senator at the time, decided to leave the Senate. my congressman, Bob Torricelli, decided to vacate his seat in the House of Representatives to run for Bill Bradley's Senate seat, thereby creating an opportunity to run for Congress. Now, it is something of a stretch, I admit, to try to go from the municipal level to Congress, but I thought, well, you know, this is the only opportunity I have. I'll give it a shot, and if that doesn't work out, I can pursue my private sector career. So I took a leave of absence from my consulting firm, and I ran for that seat. And as it turned out, I mounted a primary campaign against Steve Rothman, who eventually was elected to Congress. I acquired a mortgage on my house, spent $100,000 that could have been money that would play in, that could have played in the internet boom years later and didn't. Pissed off just about everybody in the political or in the party organization. So I spent all of this money, worked really hard, and I lost 8-1. And then, as happens in New Jersey when you challenge the party, I was sent off into the wilderness and was persona non grata and, you know, gone forever. And so I was, you know, returned to the private sector. Fast forward to 2001, another one of those crazy things happened in politics. We had redistricting. And so, to my pleasant surprise, my hometown of Fairlawn was placed in a brand new legislative district, the 38th Legislative District, which was a string of 13 towns that stretched from Elmwood Park and Fairlawn in the west across the waste of Bergen County to Fort Lee and Cliffside Park on the Hudson. Those towns being very strong Democratic towns. It was at best a very competitive district. And I was itching to get back. And I approached the party leadership and I said, you know, Fairlawn's the biggest town in this new District 38. You really need someone with a strong base in Fairlawn. Why don't you take me back and let me run for the assembly? And after a number of meetings, they decided that that was a good idea. And so I ran for the assembly in 2003 in a brand new district that they really didn't expect me to win. It was a very competitive district. I was running with the state senator at the time, Joe Coniglio. Much to everyone's surprise, we all won, the three of us. And so that was when I got to the legislature.
Wow. People probably didn't know about that in-between story, running for the House. Some people may have.
Something I actually try to forget about.
But you didn't know until you got threw your hat in the ring, I guess. Sometimes you have to do that. So then, like you said, fast forward to 2004, you're in the assembly now in a redistrict area. How did the assembly look during that time in terms of party affiliation?
It was interesting. There was a lot of turnover in the legislature that year. I was elected with the same time as Bill Baroni, later of Bridgegate fame, and a number of people who eventually moved up to the Senate with me. Jeff Van Drew, who we just ran a very competitive congressional race. He had actually gotten elected 2 years before me, but I sort of came up through the assembly with him and Brian Stack, the now current senator from Hudson County, mayor of Union City. It was during the McGreevy administration, so there was the Democrats pretty much controlled things. I was never part of a minority party in the legislature. I was always part of the majority. And I think we had good leadership at the time, and Albie O'Series, who was then Speaker, but is now a member of Congress, and Joe Roberts, who later became Speaker. They were great mentors to me. I continued my interest in environmental issues, which I had pursued even at the municipal level, and I was on the Environment Committee and on the Health Committee. I had been a hospital consultant, so I had a great interest in healthcare as well. And so I was, enjoyed the assembly very much. And it was just fun to be part of a legislative body where you can be an entrepreneur, you get interested in a particular issue or something emerges that's really important for your district, and you can figure out what the solution is and then try to advance it through the process, which I always enjoy.
Yeah. Quick question for you on the committee side of things. How does that get sorted out in the legislature? Is that by, like, you volunteer, you get appointed, volunteered?
Well, as I remember, they, at least when I was there, the new members were, I guess all the members are asked to express their preference there for committees. And I think volunteered for three or four committees, which was probably excessive. But I got all the committees I wanted, environment, appropriations, health.
So the majority leader kind of makes that decision, or?
The leadership makes that decision.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, to the extent that I was coming from a county that has perhaps more influence than many. Bergen County was one of the more important counties politically, and I have the support of the leadership at the county level. You generally got, what you wanted.
Okay. And that's your time in the assembly, and then from there.
And then another one of those crazy things happened, so that, it's totally unexpected. Senator Coniglio, was my senator. We had a new U.S. attorney by the name of Chris Christie, who was interested in making a name for himself, I think, and focused much of his attention on sort of political corruption or things that he thought were violations of the ethics code. He at one point indicted something like 40 people. My senator, Senator Coniglio, found himself in sort of some trouble. He eventually went to jail. The reality was that he needed to be replaced on the ticket in District 38. Now, at this point, I had served 4 years in the legislature. I was perceived as sort of a policy wonky guy, not one of the political insiders. No one expected that I would be in the running for the Senate seat. And at about that time, as I said, about 40 people were indicted, including a number of colleagues in the legislature. And at that time, the Record political columnist Charlie Style did a column on me entitled Boy Scout Bob, which, I don't remember the details of it, but it was a pretty positive piece. And friends of mine were urging the party leadership, at a time where we have all this corruption and concerns about ethics, wouldn't Bob Gordon be the right choice? And whether that was it or other things, I got the nod to run for the Senate. So in 2007, I ran for the Senate and won. I mean, again, knocking on thousands of doors, going to every Girl Scout ceremony. And so I began what would be a 10-year Senate career.
Okay. So that gets us into the Senate times. And as you said, you were never in the minority party. So as you moved in the Senate, with governorship changed from Grevy to Corzine, is that?
Yes, and...
So was there any big changes? Well, I guess the other thing would be, you know, obviously in terms of move jumping up from the assembly to being a senator, what was your first kind of initial reactions?
Well, you know, it is very different. I didn't appreciate it. You know, they kind of refer to it as the College of Cardinals in New Jersey. I mean, so you go from an institution with 80 people to one with 40, and really, you know, you're part of your caucus. So I would, I found myself in a beautiful conference room with a long conference table with about, you know, 23 people sitting around it who are the senators. And, you know, each one of them, you know, I think a formidable person in one way or another. The Senate president at the time was Dick Cody, who had been governor after McGreevy for a short time. You know, and senators have more power than members of the assembly. You know, most citizens don't appreciate this, but senators play a very critical role in making appointments. The governor in New Jersey cannot appoint anyone to a board or position requiring Senate confirmation unless the senator from that nominee's county signs off on it. It's something called senatorial courtesy, which is, you know, there's arguments for and against this practice, but it gives the legislative branch, particularly the Senate, some parity with the governor in terms of power. So that was different. And it was a place where it's easier to have an impact on policy and drive initiatives, which is what I liked about it. I got on the health committee, which, you know, has remained an interest. I was on the environment committee. And there were a number of, you know, projects that I undertook, which, you know, I'm still proud about.
Very good. And then obviously in both houses, then big part of being in the legislature, being part of the budget, did you find that to be a big responsibility in terms
of? I was never on the budget committee.
Okay.
And one of the reasons was that, you know, in the past, you know, there had been some, you know, there had been accusations that certain that members of the budget committee were just involved in things that they weren't. I mean, Senator Coniglio in particular had gotten into trouble, I think, on the budget committee. And, you know, that stayed with me, and I just wanted to avoid anything like that. And I was more interested in the other, you know, other areas of public policy anyway. But I'm sorry, where were you?
No, that was just one question I had. And the other one that I kind of asked before, while you were in the Senate, just in general, for 10 years, you were under working with different governors. Did that obviously bring about different types of approaches and challenges? You worked with Republican and Democratic governors during that time. So,
yeah.
And you mentioned Christie.
So, you know, as someone who, I mean, I at one point, after a couple of years in the Senate, I became the Senate Majority Conference Leader, which sounds pretty impressive. But most of the power in the Senate resides with the Senate President. You know, he or she is the individual who's negotiating with the governor over, you know, over how a policy is shaped. My role in the caucus was mainly to guide my fellow senators through the bills. And when I asked Senator Sweeney why he wanted me in that role, he said, "Well, we know you read the bills." there, you know, because I wasn't dealing directly with the governors, I can't say that I dealing with one governor change. Was different than another. What I always try to do, and I take some pride in this, I think this began during my service in Fairlawn on the council. The council always had a couple of factions, and so to get anything done, I always wanted to have a working relationship with the other side. And I take a great deal of pride in the fact that I formed some pretty close friendships with my colleagues in the legislature on the other side of the aisle, which I thought made me a more effective legislator, because I could pick up the phone and call a Republican senator and say, hey, you know, this is a problem that's affecting your district too. Let's work on a bill together. And so I could get Republican votes for something I was working on. And so I was really focused less on the governor than building relationships within the legislative branch.
Gotcha. That makes sense. And then just a couple other questions before we kind of move on to New Jersey Transit and the BPU. A couple big events in New Jersey, notable at least to the public while you were in the Senate, one being Bridgegate. Did you have any involvement I guess in some way, shape or form, kind of everyone did. So can you describe any of your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I knew most of the players, you know, pretty well. I mean, as I mentioned before, Bill Baroni, who was, eventually went to trial with Bridget Kelly. Bill was a friend. We had some tense times during that period, but have sort of renewed our friendship. I knew David Wildstein. We also had some tense times, but have sort of repaired that relationship since. This whole, the Bridgegate blew open because Senator Weinberg, you know, like the pit bull that she is, I should say that Loretta Weinberg, who I've known for probably over 40 years, she was one of the first people I met in politics in the 70s, who has been something of a mentor to me, actually is a mentor to me. She knew that there was some shenanigans going on and she pursued that. In any case, we knew that there were lots of problems at the Port Authority. And so one of my major legislative projects became trying to reform the Port Authority Board. At about that time, Senator Sweeney gave me the opportunity to chair something called the Legislative Oversight Committee, which, you know, is really empowered to investigate anything that looks not right. And of course, there's no shortage of material in state government. But I held numerous hearings on the Port Authority and with Senator Weinberg and colleagues in New York State, which was particularly interesting, developed reform legislation to increase the transparency and accountability of the Port Authority Board. And that was I think that was one of my major legislative projects. And it actually provided the foundation for the reform legislation that I authored, again with Senator Weinberg, on New Jersey Transit. Much of the language is right out of the Port Authority bill. But that Port Authority project was quite an undertaking. It went through several iterations. And what was really challenging is that any kind of reform for a bi-state agency like the Port Authority requires an identical bill to pass through the New York legislature. So if getting a bill through New Jersey is a challenge, you know, it becomes twice as hard because I had to find sponsors and colleagues in the New York Senate and assembly there to sponsor a bill. And we moved our bills simultaneously through both, you know, in Albany and Trenton, working very closely together. It was actually a fascinating experience.
Wow. That's interesting, especially the comments on how that kind of a lot of the language then got put into the New Jersey Transit Reform Bill. And One other question I had on then is on the, you said you're on the oversight committee and you're also the transportation, that New Jersey Transit Oversight Committee, you're also a part of.
Well, what happened was I was initially chairman of the Legislative Oversight Committee. Mm-hmm. Because I was spending so much time on New Jersey Transit and the Port Authority, and as a result, developing some expertise on transportation issues in New Jersey, Senator Sweeney at one point said, you know, why don't we make you chairman of the Transportation Committee? But that was only for a few months towards the end of my Senate career. I did much of my work on New Jersey Transit as the chair of the Legislative Oversight Committee.
Got it. Thank you for that. And then one last question, or maybe two. Do you think there should be term limits in the New Jersey state or for senators, assemblymen, and women?
You know,
and if so, should the voters decide if there should be?
My personal view is I don't think there should be term limits. First of all, the public should realize there's a tremendous amount of turnover in the legislature. I mean, it's not like you don't have too many people who are there for years and years. There are a handful, but what they bring is some institutional memory, and there's value to knowing that this idea that someone's pushing this year may have been tried 10 years before and was an absolute failure, and no one else is around who remembers why it was a failure. And it's good to have some people like that around. I don't think it's a particular problem in New Jersey, maybe in other states, because, you know, there just is a lot of turnover. I mean, you know, I can remember years where, you know, of the, you know, the 40 senators, you know, maybe, you know, 8 or 10 turned over.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And before I forget, on the Weinberg comment that you made, I spoke to her early this week. She's going to be on the show later, and she had a question for you. So I'm going to ask, remind me to ask you the Weinberg question at the end. We'll save that for the end.
Okay. I'm a little worried about that one.
No, it's nothing hard. She had something that she wanted me to ask. So we'll do that. Moving on now, then let's get into your current kind of responsibilities, still serving New Jersey public in different ways now, through New Jersey Transit, being a board member and as a commissioner on the Board of Public Utilities. I guess we could start with, even though you started with BPU first, maybe we'll start with transit, if you're okay with that. So you became a board member of New Jersey Transit in early 20.
Yeah, the public should recognize that I left the Senate. I left the Senate in April of 2018 after the governor's office approached me and to appoint me to the Board of Public Utilities. So I left the legislative branch.
To go directly. Okay.
In December of 2018, the governor signed reform legislation that Senator Weinberg and I co-sponsored, you know, much of the language taken from the Port Authority legislation, to initiate reforms at New Jersey Transit, which included changing the size and membership of the board. The idea was to make it more like a corporate board of directors, to be actively involved in debating and shaping policies, as opposed to be, you know, sort of a top-down, staff-driven organization. In January of 2020, early 2020, late 2019, I was nominated to serve as a board member of New Jersey Transit, which is uncompensated. It's a volunteer position. And I was confirmed, I think, in February. My first board transit board meeting, I think, was in February of 2020. Just had another meeting in March, and then the world just shut down.
I was going to say, just in time for the pandemic, and we'll get into that in a minute. But before that, quick question. The general public or some folks seem to think that the Board of New Jersey Transit is traditionally known as a rubber stamp in terms of just saying yes to board agenda items and board meetings and then going home and coming back and doing it all. So I have to ask you, are you a rubber stamp, Bob?
I'm not a rubber stamp. And since I'm not likely to be running for office again, you know, I really don't care too much about the any political fallout. You know, I'm at a stage in my career where, you know, I don't really mind getting the powers that be angry with me. No, I'm not a rubber stamp, but I can understand why the public may think that the transit board was, because the old transit board really was. First of all, I mean, before the reform legislation, there were like three members of the board. They were all state employees. It was the commissioner of transportation and people from the governor's office and from the treasurer's office. They were all ex officios. There were vacancies. And they, you know, there wasn't any kind of debate on issues. I don't think there was, or not much debate. And I don't want to denigrate any of those individuals who served them, but there was not a lot of debate on the board. And the reform legislation was meant to promote a more, if not an activist board, a more engaged board, in which board members would put things on the agenda that they wanted to talk about and initiate a debate with their fellow board members on how to go about solving a particular problem. Because I think that kind of process, as in the corporate world, and during my private sector career, I was a consultant to corporate boards, so I know something about this. I think better public policy emerges when there is a vigorous debate in a forum like that with input from staff. You know, we were not looking to create a board that inserted themselves in day-to-day administration. That's not the intention at all, but there should be a board engaged in shaping policies and programs with in collaboration with senior management. So that was what we were trying to do with the reform legislation. Are we there yet? I don't think so, but I think we're making progress. And if it looks as if we're voting yes on everything, I would point out that if there is a good deal of disagreement about how we should go about doing something, you know, it's generally not put up on the agenda for a vote. I would point out that in one of our first meetings, there was an item that was everyone expected to be rubber stamped. It was a extension of a contract for paratransit services. And, this is an area that I think there's an opportunity to improve the quality of the service and perhaps organize it differently. So I and other members of the board, and I should say my colleagues on the board, all are very capable people with, you know, their own unique set of experiences, which are extraordinarily valuable. And a number of my colleagues shared concerns with me that we shouldn't be locking ourselves into a long-term contract for paratransit. This is the transportation services for the disabled. You see access link buses, that's what that's all about. So we thought, you know, 7-year contract, no. I mean, there may be some very significant changes in the next couple of years. We don't want to lock ourselves into something as long as that. We want, you know, and there were also complaints about, you know, some of the bidders and the way they were running the programs. And we wanted answers. We wanted answers to some of our questions. As it turned out, we changed the contract. We said, no, it's going to be a 3-year contract, not a 7-year contract. And we will take another look at this. And we may want to explore a different approach to providing transportation for the disabled. So is that a major victory? I don't know. But it's one of those small steps that I think is moving us in the right direction.
No, it's a good example. And that's still kind of ongoing, some of the stuff related to the paratransit I've seen, both in the legislature and with the board. So I was going to ask you, I mean, kind of got into it when you started at New Jersey Transit. You already had background from your, and you had the opportunity to be on both sides of the fence. You had oversight and wrote the reform bill with others. And then all of a sudden you're on the board itself. So you kind of were on both sides of the fence there. So
although I would say that, you know, an appropriate role for the board is oversight. You know, the board is like in a corporation, monitors the performance of senior management. Again, we're growing in this role, but I think, it is something, an oversight role. It's not all that far removed from what from the questions I was asking in the legislature.
Right. So when you got in there, then was there any big surprise? I mean, obviously with the pandemic, but was there any surprises just pre-pandemic with what you were seeing? And is there anything that metrics or reporting or things like that you weren't seeing that you expected to, and things that you like?
You know, if I can get a little political here, if there is a legacy of the Christie administration, you know, I really think it is the destruction of New Jersey Transit. And then maybe that's too strong a word, but you know, the organization was just starved for resources. This is the third largest mass transit system in the country. And, you know, you can only do that for so long. I mean, we're literally not putting money into new buses and equipment because we, you know, had to pay the operating budget. It's not like, it's like not fixing your house and putting the money into groceries. You know, at some point the roof starts leaking. But that's kind of the situation we found. I think there's a major effort underway to try to get resources back into the infrastructure and into staff and into modern information technology and all the things that we need to do that our customers expect. It's not going to be turned around overnight. I know the public is very impatient. We've had another challenge in having to comply with a federal mandate to implement something called positive train control, which is an emergency braking system that has to be in place on, you know, all of our lines. And we have a December 31 deadline. And so that's, you know, uppermost on our mind as well. You know, I think to answer your question, I guess I didn't appreciate just what a devastating effect the disinvestment had on the organization.
Understood. So that led itself to a lot of challenges, it sounds like, in general. The pandemic came and
yeah. So I, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I sign on to this new role, and all of a sudden, the pandemic strikes, and 90% of your business disappears. You know, the ridership dropped, you know, as we know, precipitously on New Jersey Transit and every other major mass transit system in the world.
Yeah, exactly. So that presented a whole new set of challenges on top of the ones that you just kind of broadly laid out. And how are you finding it, trying to work through those challenges?
Well, you know, a lot of the things that we would want to normally do, like focus on like service enhancements, you know, we're just trying to keep our head above water. I mean, this is the greatest, probably the greatest financial and operational challenge in the history of New Jersey Transit, and probably for every other major mass transit system. You know, we're trying to restore ridership. You know, all of a sudden, you know, your revenue drops 60-80%. You know, where does that money come from? Well, we got some money from Washington, but that'll be good only for so long. At some point, you know, that money gets expended, and you know, you see the MTA across the river saying, you know, unless we get so many $1 billion, we're gonna have to start cutting routes and major service cuts. You know, and you know, we
That's something you're exploring at New Jersey Transit as well?
Well, we're looking, we have, you know, in developing our budget, we considered several scenarios. Doing our best to preserve the resources that we have. We're assuming that ridership will, the impact of a second wave, we're hoping that ridership grows slowly back. You know, none of us knows what the future of commuting holds. I mean, we don't know whether people are going to be going to return to New York and office buildings or what. But we are, and we have studies underway to try to analyze what the future may hold. But we're hopeful, particularly with a new administration in Washington, one that we think will be much more, look much more kindly on mass transit systems in the Northeast, that we'll be able to get some additional federal resources to hold us over until we get the system back where it needs to be.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that was a question that I had for you, which is exactly that. Do you think a Biden administration will be favorable for New Jersey Transit, and how quickly might New Jersey Transit reap the benefits of that?
Well, in the budget discussions we had, I made the point a couple of times with staff that, and we were putting the budget together just, within the last few weeks, and we were doing this while the polls are all, incorrectly pointing to a Biden landslide. I was saying, if we have a new administration, this is an administration that's probably going to advance a major infrastructure funding program for job creation and rebuilding the economy, and one that will be focusing not just on transportation and public infrastructure, but also clean energy as well. I said the odds are we're going to, there'll be some money available, and we need to make sure that these projects that we're talking about in the budget are get through the design phase and, are ready to go. And there's, the term uses shovel ready, so that if there's money available, we can just pull the trigger and start getting these projects underway. And in answer to your question, I think that what you're going to see, much will depend on the relationship that President Biden develops with the Senate, if the Senate stays under Republican control. But, infrastructure can be a pretty bipartisan subject. And I'm hopeful that, we can get some spending out there, which will be good to, help rejuvenate the economy as well as, give us the infrastructure we need. I think there's a good chance we're going to see the Gateway Project jump started. That is the project that will build new rail tunnels across the Hudson to replace the 110-year-old tunnels that were built before the Wright brothers and are, could fail, within the next few years, which would be catastrophic for the whole region. We've had some good news on the Portal Bridge project, which is part of Gateway, which is the replacement of a 100-year-old bridge in the Meadowlands. I think we're going to, we're going to see some things that can be done through executive action, regardless of what Congress says, and hopefully some major initiatives that reflect a collaboration between the Congress and the new president.
Makes sense. And then also, I wanted to ask you about they called the Transit Grid Project, which was formally, I think started
2014,
right after seeing, gas, originally gas powered, 24/7 plant to run backup power for New Jersey Transit. And recently, just very recently, The board made some formal decisions regarding committees and openness to committing to a lot of that being renewable energy, solar powered. And it's kind of interesting because for someone like yourself, with your other background being with the Board of Public Utilities. So how do you see that working out? Were you happy to see that?
You know, this was a very, very interesting experience for me. You know, first of all, for the benefit of your listeners, microgrids are a facility that can provide power independent of the grid. You know, for example, Princeton University built its own power generating system. I think it's powered by clean energy. So that when Sandy came along and all of our lights went out, the lights in Princeton stayed on. It's called a distributed energy resource, the technical term. And I think many of us in the utility sector see the future in building more microgrids. And certainly at a time when we're living in a world in which our foreign adversaries through cyber warfare can shut down our grid in probably about 15 minutes if they wanted to, and we could do the same to them. It's important to have these microgrids in operation just so that you can keep the lights on and critical resources available. So the idea after Sandy, this was more in response to a weather event, but it would also be helpful in the case of a cyber attack. The idea was to build a microgrid that could keep the trains running between New Brunswick and Penn Station, New York, for a couple of weeks until the system was able to get restored. And this was going to be a natural gas powered plant with some solar backup that was going to be built in the Meadowlands, I think in Kearney. It got over $400 million in federal support for this as part of their resilience program. And when I first looked at it, I thought, well, seems like a pretty good idea because, you know, if something happened and we had 1,000 people under the Hudson, you know, you'd be able to get them back home to safety. And then it was interesting for me because the involvement of the public really got me to think about whether this was such a great idea. I had signed on to the transit board assuming that these were going to be 2-hour meetings and I got home. Well, it turns out that so many people were coming to our meetings or signing up for a virtual meeting. We'd have 75 people sign up to speak, nearly all of them against the microgrid. So the meetings that I thought would go for 2 hours turned out to go for 6 or 7 hours. But, you know, all of that public outcry, which often was, you know, more emotional than fact-based, but it got all of us on the board to think, is it a good idea to at this time to go forward with an idea that may have made sense in 2014, but in 2020 with the major advances in microgrid technology and renewable energy and battery storage.
And the expenses for them as well, right?
Does that make sense to do this? And to the credit of the staff of New Jersey Transit, they said, you know what? Let's take a fresh look at this. And so what we decided to do is basically go back to the drawing board, and we're offering stipends to companies to come up with their best idea for powering a microgrid in a more clean energy, carbon reduced way. That's the direction we're moving. And I think that with the change in administration, we're likely to find people in Washington who are receptive to the idea, who are not trying to preserve fossil fuels, And would be supportive of the idea of advanced energy storage technology to support something like this. It could be, you know, the first in the country to do this. So it's still very early in the process, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
Great, that's
and
great.
I kudos to the public, you know, who came to all those meetings.
They were relentless. I heard a couple of those 6-hour meetings myself. That's a good point. What I think we'll do, if you have a little bit of time, sure, we'll break it up into two episodes, because we got a couple, like a 1A and 1B of Bob Gordon. we'll do a couple more questions with New Jersey Transit. And
let's
then
see what the ratings look like after this.
Well, it'll be interesting because we'll split them and this will be on. It'll be the life and story of Bob Gordon leading up to... Well, and then New Jersey.
Well, that's a snoozer.
And then the BPU will be maybe shorter. We'll see, and it'll be 1B, and we'll see what gets more views and listens as well. Because I know we're around an hour, so let's try to wrap some things up on New Jersey Transit. It's a ton to talk about, and we'd love to have you back. But while we're on the electric, and you know, the grid stuff, and also with your background. Now New Jersey Transit's been kind of, I think they've, in terms of busing, they've purchased just this year alone, something like 500 diesel powered buses, but also more recently, a smaller portion of electric buses. So it's kind of confusing in terms of, you know, like what you were just saying, what the governor has said in New Jersey about New Jersey's plan, in terms of getting off fossil fuels and things like that. So should the public be confused about that in terms of why are we?
I mean, I was a little confused about it as well. I mean, but the fact is that, you know, we have our current bus fleet, is so old. I mean, the people who are riding these every day, I mean, they know how that affects the quality of their life. The parts are getting hard to find. They're breaking down more frequently because they're long beyond their lifespan. They're not comfortable. Battery technology for buses is a relatively new thing. These buses are very expensive, far more expensive than a regular bus. And I think the decision was made that, you know, we just need to be able to upgrade the fleet in a very substantial way. We can place an order today for diesel buses. I mean, you know, they're not going to be arriving for some time. I think some will be, but so we've ordered these articulated buses, which will represent a major improvement. Now, at the same time, the legislature passed legislation with a mandate for major initiatives in vehicle electrification, both passenger vehicles and buses. My personal preference is I think we should be a little bit more aggressive than we have been. We have a pilot project underway in Camden, and also one in Maplewood, I believe, at the Maplewood Garage. Other bus systems are going into electrification in a bigger way. Again, I'm hopeful that with some new resources coming from Washington that'll be supporting things like bus electrification, we will be able to ramp it up. You know, I think certainly the will is there.
Right.
It's very different than running a system with diesel buses. You know, repairs are different, the parts are different. The operating costs are actually much lower than internal combustion engines or diesel engines, but the upfront costs are higher. You need to build charging facilities. I think we're gonna ramp it up. And I also happen to think there's been a lot of attention focused on the environmental justice community, the so-called environmental justice community, which are in reality are people who are living in the city, exposed to diesel fumes and soot and all the things that contribute to respiratory diseases. And I think rather than focusing as much attention as we are on building charging stations in cities, we should be putting the money into replacing buses and school buses and vehicle, municipal government fleets of vehicles, and the things that affect the air in our urban areas. You know, that's my personal view.
No, that's a good point. And kind of brings up a couple, it's a good point on the, as well on the outdated busing that buses that New Jersey Transit has, the fact that a lot of the ridership now is on buses, with less coming, slower returning on rail. So it seems like that would be a focus, I would hope, for the agency right now. But I did want to ask you, because you brought up the charging stations for cars, and you know, public's aware of the New Jersey toll hikes, right? That's widely known to publicized to raise something like $24 billion, and that's going into road widening or efficiency, whatever the terminology is. It's going towards roads and, you know, probably a lot of needed things, of course. Do you think that that's appropriate expenditure going all to roads, or would you like to see some of that going to transit as well? I mean, $24 billion, we already talked about the lack of funding that New Jersey Transit has as a whole, so.
Well, again, my personal view, I think that, you know.
Because it's probably not too late, by the way.
All right, and from what I understand, there have been discussions, I believe, coming from the governor and from the Department of Transportation to allocate additional resources from the Transportation Trust Fund to New Jersey Transit. You know, in a state like New Jersey that is so dependent on mass transit, you know, really our economy and our economic future depends on mass transit. You know, I would like to see more resources going into mass transit than roads. I mean, we can expand our light rail systems. We can, you know, make the improvements we've been talking about in terms of improving buses and rail service. You know, I think we ought to give some thought to expanding the use of ferries in the New York metropolitan area as a way of getting people to New York if people are going to return to New York. But I generally would like to see more resources going into mass transit. Those are decisions made at a higher level. You know, yep. I have my views, which I'm expressing. I may be getting in trouble for expressing them, but, you know, that's my view. We should be putting more into mass transit.
Well, we don't want you to get in trouble, Bob. So let me know if I'm asking anything that you can't answer, then feel free to just shut me down. But I had another question for you on the reform bill. We talked about it before. For those that don't know, there's another transit reform bill that's again, I believe sponsored by Weinberg or Senator Weinberg. She's definitely a part of it. And it's been drafted and it's in, you know, hasn't really gone anywhere yet, but it's there in the state legislature and it's been out now for maybe 4 or 5 plus months. And then I guess we could talk about a couple things that it's doing, which I think in large part, it's trying to cement some of the holes that, or maybe in the first one that were unforeseen, and also kind of capping it and topping it up with more independency And maybe you have your own take on it as well, which I'd be interested to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk in too much detail because it's, I think it still is a work in process.
Right, yeah, could get amended.
It is kind of in draft form. You know, I don't think it's gone before a committee.
Right.
Yet.
So it's just the way it stands now. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I think the Senator Weinberg is looking at the way the 2018 legislation has been implemented, sees that there may be some opportunities to strengthen that, fill in some blanks that were left in the original bill. I know there's interest in trying to restructure the customer service operation. That's, you know, I don't know the details of the bill, and this is based on what I've heard.
I think that part is supposed to become a little more independent, where prior was reporting to New Jersey Transit senior management, now either to the board or to the legislature, but independent of that. So that, I think you're right there. And then another part piece that stands out, like you said, without reading it line for line, but that's been written about in the media, is the fact that the chairperson would be appointed by the board members, as it stands now, as it's written, whereas in current legislation, it's the DOT commissioner. Right. So those are two of the things. I think there's a lot of things related to the budget as well. I don't see the way that the budget's given to the board, so I'm not sure what you guys have seen, but I think it's supposed to be condensed into more of like what you would see maybe from like a port authority or something like that.
If I could just comment on the budget for a minute, because you know, it's fresh in my mind because we just went through some of the deliberations. I was hoping that the board, like a corporate board, would be more involved in the development of the budget. Now this year we had, because it was such a strange year with the pandemic, with the fiscal year being changed and the board members coming on sort of in the middle of the process, I don't think we were really able to perform the role that, you know, I had hoped we would when I drafted the original legislation. I've expressed the view that I would hope that in the coming fiscal year that we are more engaged at an early stage. I know a number of my colleagues feel the same way, but it's also important for the public to understand something. And I didn't really appreciate this until I started getting through the numbers. You know, in a, there's a relatively small, very small percentage of the New Jersey Transit budget that really is discretionary that we can make decisions about. So much of the budget, you know, maybe 90%+, I don't recall. I remember something like only $30 million out of a, you know, $2 billion budget plus is discretionary because we're locked into labor contracts and fuel contracts and contracts for services with private buses. There's just not a lot of opportunity to allocate money to something new. So it's important to keep that in mind, but doesn't mean we shouldn't be involved in the process early on.
Understood. Thank you for that. And kind of closing things up, I think we spoke a lot here about New Jersey Transit, but just a couple quick ones. Do you think that, and then we talked about the response to the pandemic has been adequate in terms of masks and compliance and, the way that social distancing is done via rail cars and things like that, just in general, what you're hearing, seeing, or the metrics you're receiving. Obviously, you have customer service reports. I know, I've heard you specifically say that ask for certain types of statistics and things like that, but do you think the response has been adequate? At least, obviously, in the beginning, it was a lot of unknowns and things like that. So that I'm talking about kind of more towards the last couple of months and things like that.
Yeah. But I don't want to get too far into this because, I mean, we just read this week that there's some litigation coming along related to this. But, I would say this in general that, and this applies to, I think, every mass transit system operating in a pandemic. There has to be some shared responsibility. I mean, the public has to, if the bus comes along and it's too full and people feel uncomfortable getting on a bus that's crowded, they should wait for the next one. I understand that may be easier said than done.
Right. If it's an hour away and they have to get to work.
I get what you're saying. But, we need the help of the public as well. Needless to say, we're doing everything we can now to get people to wear masks, both employees and our customers, and exercise social distancing and, do all the things we know we're supposed to be doing. I think I probably should leave it at that.
Okay. That sounds good. I agree. Public needs to do their part. It's hard. You can't babysit thousands of people who are moving around the state on different vehicles. So I just had another question, just kind of moving into 2021 then. And we talked a lot about the cost and the budget and this and that. So do you think that there's an adequate or too much or an adequate amount of outsourcing of whether they're different things? So pick whatever or all of them, outsourcing bus lines. We've read about in the news, obviously bus lines that have been outsourced but run by New Jersey Transit have gone bankrupt or aren't running anymore. And then also secondarily outsourcing of projects, consultants, things like that, that kind of layer on costs to the agency. Do you see the consultancy project part being a big organization itself, or what looks like one, as too much expense and added layer? And then do you have any thoughts on the outsourcing of buses and kind of what happened during that part?
Let me take up the consultants first. First of all, people hear that New Jersey Transit has 12,000 employees, but most of those employees are people who are driving buses or locomotives or conductors or working in repair shops. The bureaucracy is, not the massive organization that some people might think. And much of the expertise needed for these consulting projects are really it's difficult to find it internally. And I was speaking with the bias of a former management consultant, I would point out that, one of the benefits of bringing someone from the outside to do an analysis is that you can hire an organization that has been looking at the particular issue all over the country and knows who's doing it right and what the best practices are. And there's just a benefit in having a fresh view. So we brought in this consultant called North Highland. The governor brought them in shortly after he took office to just take a fresh look at New Jersey Transit from top to bottom. And the report, I think, is very helpful and points to a number of areas that can be improved. And unfortunately, the pandemic came along as we're starting to implement some of these things, although much progress, I think, has been made. So there's a, I think there's a benefit in bringing people from the outside. It's important for the board to exercise oversight and control over these projects. You know, we don't want to create a gravy train for consultants, you know, and there has to be a value for the money. And that's our job to assure that. But I think in most cases, these people are bringing in expertise that we don't have internally, and we want the benefit of a fresh look. In terms of the private buses, I mean, the transit has a long history of using these outside bus services to provide service where we might not have a garage, and it's more cost effective in a particular part of the state to make use of you know, the Ajax bus company, because they have a bus garage, and the deal we work out with them is that you know, we provide them with the equipment, and they're providing the personnel to run them. What I think has been unfortunate is that during the pandemic, the federal legislation that was approved to provide some financial relief, as we've been told, prevents the money from going to private organizations. So this, what we find ourselves in is a situation where the dollar amount New Jersey Transit gets from the federal government is based on the mileage driven by buses, for example, total mileage, including mileage contributed by these private carriers. But then another part of the legislation says, oh, but you can't give any of this money to private companies. So the private companies are saying, hey, you know, what's this all about? You know, we helped you generate these funds. We deserve part of the money. And we're trying to find an answer to that. The best answer may be to revise the federal legislation to give us the flexibility to provide some relief to the private companies, which are performing an important role.
Got it. Thank you. That's a good summary for the public to understand kind of the dynamics of the fund, the CARES Act funding that was received, and how it was delegated, and some of the challenges that go along with it. So last question for part one, Bob Gordon, part one.
Is this a Loretta Weinberg question?
No, that's at the end of part two. So everyone watch this one. They have to watch the next one too. That's funny. So just the last word on New Jersey Transit. What as you go into 2021, fingers crossed, pandemic starts to ease up. What do you want to see more of in your role as a board member? You know, what are some of the critical things that you think can be enhanced, whether it's reporting on items, like you said, it's an oversight role, but you still need to have your tentacles on things. So like, what do you see as like one or two critical areas? Obviously, they're all important, so we understand that. As we move into, let's say, farther into 2021, what do you want to see as a board member since you've been in the role for about a year?
You know, first of all, one of the things I think I've neglected to say in our entire conversation is that, you know, we have to give a lot of credit to Governor Murphy for, you know, in contrast to his predecessor, he really understands that the future, the economic future of the state and our quality of life depends on rebuilding New Jersey Transit. So everything the board is doing, fortunately, we are doing with you know, the help of Governor Murphy, and you know, he's been you know, critical in all of this. He's the one who's, you know, made the budget decisions that more money should be going into infrastructure, and we should be electrifying buses and doing what we can to improve the customer experience. You know, so you know, I just want to get that, you know, on the table. But in answer to your question, you know, I would hope that as the comfort level between the New Jersey Transit Organization and the board increases. I think hopefully we're going to see some, you know, the board playing a greater role and being involved in the budget development process and having input into the decision making and the shaping of policy. I mean, that's what the reform bill intended. I think we're going to get there. It is natural for any organization to, you know, to suffer from some inertia and not change as quickly as some might want to see. But I think we're going to get there. You know, again, the good news is that we're likely to get more resources for new vehicles and equipment and repairing bridges. And, you know, the governor is behind all of that. And we'll have someone in the White House, I hope, who will be providing us with the resources that we need, who is, you know, a friend of mass transit. So I'm feeling pretty optimistic.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Ending on a positive note. Thank you for all of that. I really appreciate it. The public will appreciate it, I'm sure. You know, to have these kind of conversations and from the feedback that we've gotten in terms of hearing the full thought process of people like yourself, I think is pretty invaluable to the public. So I really appreciate it. That's part one of Bob Gordon. So thank you for tuning in. We'll be back in a second.
It's been this is a long interview.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was like, we're probably like bumping up to an hour and a half.
For those of your audience who are still awake, I want to thank them for listening and thank you for having me. And it was fun for me. And, I hope it was some of the information was useful.
Absolutely. Save that for part two, though. We don't want to give everything away.
Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around. Yeah. Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate.
Garden State Debate. Yeah.